call it another sign of Facebook's dominance in the social media world. This past week, the website MySpace, Facebook's one-time rival, announced it was laying off nearly half its workforce. The collapse of MySpace comes at a pivotal time in the dot-com world. Private investors have hundreds of millions of dollars riding on the success of such popular social media sites as Facebook, Groupon, Living Social, and LinkedIn. Industry watchers say another investment bubble could be brewing, much like the one that gave way to the dot-com bust at the beginning of this century. For insight, we've invited Beverly Macy to our studios here in Washington, D.C. She is CEO of the social media marketing conference Gravity Summit and the author of The Power of Real-Time Social Media Marketing. It is so nice to meet you, Beverly.
Nice to be here.
Let's start with the MySpace news. After announcing the layoffs, News Corp, the media conglomerate which owns MySpace, said it's considering selling the site. Is the site worth buying?
MySpace is one of those stories that everybody is watching with great interest. It was the king of the roost for a long time, and they had a great audience. And social media is all about finding the audience and then meeting them where they want to be met. And MySpace grew and grew and grew, and now it is on the decline. Will we see it totally die out? That remains to be seen. So we'll have to watch and see.
Let's talk about Facebook, because it reportedly raised $500 million from the investment firm Goldman Sachs and a Russian investor, and the deal values Facebook at $50 billion, which means it's worth twice as much as Starbucks and Dell. What's going on?
Well, what's going on is 500 million users and growing, 600 million now. There is a phenomenon brewing. We are seeing a seismic shift in how people are communicating, and Facebook has really tapped into the desire for people to connect, to do more than connect about their plans, etc. Now they want to shop on Facebook. They want to transact on Facebook. They want to share photos. They want to share their lives. But businesses are also looking at this. It's very exciting, and we're just at the very beginning.
But what does it mean that a company like Goldman Sachs is reconsidering social media as a business practice?
Well, that in itself is probably the most stunning part of the news. They put money to work in places that are going to absolutely pay off. So they must know something that everybody else should get on board with. I think businesses are going to take a second look at Facebook as a platform, social media as a new operationalized business process, because they don't want to be left behind. Something's going on, and this will cause people to really take a look.
Groupon, which is the online coupon site, said it closed a round of funding worth something like $950 million. The company had turned down a $6 billion acquisition from Google. Can you explain why a company like, well, Facebook, but Groupon could be worth that much money?
Well, again, probably we're going to look back and say they were smart to turn down the $6 billion. That's hard to even say those words. Groupon also has tapped into something that is absolutely lighting a fire. People love to get a deal, and it turns out they like to get a deal together. And Groupon really hit a magic formula. They believe that they're just at the beginning of really a whole new business process and a whole new revenue stream, and I think they're right.
Getting back to possible clouds on the horizon, the difference between the tech bubble 10 years ago and now is that this time the companies are privately held. Do you expect them to initiate public offerings?
Well, the whisper is that Facebook will be going public in 2012. We will see. The private offerings that's going on is getting a lot of news. You're absolutely right. I think the lesson learned from the dot-com bubble is a couple of things, one of which is you've got to have revenue and be a real business in order to go public. A lot of companies went public and then had to go private or had to totally delist off the stock market, et cetera. And these companies are earning revenue, and they're going to continue to earn revenue, so they can take their time. But we will see companies absolutely hit the ball out of the park. We'll see a couple of failures along the way as well.
Beverly Macy is CEO of the Social Media Marketing Conference Gravity Summit and author of The Power of Real-Time Social Media Marketing, and she joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you so much, Beverly.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. While the housing sector's troubles continue to drag down the economy, manufacturers are moving forward. One big reason, exports. U.S. companies are selling more and more of their goods overseas, and now business groups are stepping up the pressure on Congress and the White House to open more foreign markets to U.S. companies. Here to talk about all of this is NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn Geewax. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Good morning, Leah.
Why is trade policy getting so much attention?
Well, the one thing everyone in America wants right now is jobs, and exports are helping create some jobs. Employers who are tied to the domestic economy, and especially that housing sector, are still in so much trouble, you're just not seeing any job growth for carpenters, realtors, mortgage brokers, things like that. But U.S. manufacturing has been growing at about three times the rate of the rest of the economy. We've got foreign customers who want to buy our airplanes, pharmaceuticals, cotton, computers, all kinds of goods. So just last week, the federal government released the data for November, and it showed exports were up for the third straight month to about $160 billion. That means President Obama is going to push hard for increases in exports, and he set a goal of doubling U.S. exports by 2015.
Well, what is the administration doing to make this happen?
Well, here's one example. Last week, the U.S. Export-Import Bank said that it would launch an effort to identify about 5,000 small businesses and help them get the loans they need to boost their ability to export. And the bank recently got some attention by announcing it would help Pakistan get financing to purchase 150 locomotives made by General Electric in Erie, Pennsylvania. So now when the new Congress is settling in, the White House is going to push for approval for free trade agreements, also called FTAs, that have already been worked out with other countries.
What does the business community say about this?
Well, last week I went to hear the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's annual State of American Business Address. Tom Donahue, the chamber's president, was emphatic about the need for these FTAs. Here's what he said.
The administration must work urgently with the new Congress to approve the South Korean and Colombian and Panama agreements. We will pull out all the stops we can to help the administration get the votes to pass these bills.
Leanne, you know, the chamber is pretty good at getting what it wants when it decides to pull out all the stops.
Yeah, but where do these free trade agreements stand in Congress?
The White House is describing this South Korea deal as one of its top legislative priorities. And just the other day, the U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk said the administration would get this agreement completed in the first half of this year. This deal really matters to a lot of U.S. companies because South Korea is a huge market. It already imports about $250 billion worth of manufactured goods. And it's not just about goods. A lot of U.S. companies want to sell South Koreans their services, and those are banks, software companies, and farmers, too. They want to get this agreement because it would make it easier to sell beef and corn and pork and soybeans and all kinds of things to South Korea. So if Congress approves it, it would be by far the biggest trade deal that we've had since the North American Free Trade Agreement, that was NAFTA, in 1994.
Well, Marilyn, if business interests are for it and President Obama supports it, then it should pass, right?
Well, it may sound like this is a slam dunk given that combination of support, but trade deals are always controversial because trade works in two directions. They can help, but they can hurt. The United Auto Workers supports this deal because they hope they'll be able to sell more vehicles in that big market. But the AFL-CIO, it's opposed because so many union members, especially steel workers, fear that the trade deals always end up hurting U.S. workers. But you know, given that the tech community, the Chamber of Commerce, the United Auto Workers are all behind the agreement, I think most people bet that the administration will get its way on this.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax, thanks as always, Marilyn.
You're welcome, Leanne.
A farm girl, a librarian, a prostitute, mill worker, groovy single mother, and the darling of one of the most significant musical partnerships of the 20th century. All of those and more are career notches on the lipstick case of Shirley Jones. Ms. Jones is probably best known, at least to a certain generation, for her role as Shirley Partridge, matriarch of television's singing Partridge Family in the early 70s. Others may remember her Oscar-winning role as Lulu Baines in the 1960 film Elmer Gantry, or her performance as Laurie in the film version of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma.
Don't throw bouquets at me. Don't please my folks too much. Don't laugh at my jokes too much. People will say we're in love.
That's Shirley Jones singing People Will Say We're in Love from the 1955 film Oklahoma. Shirley Jones has always loved to sing, and she's still doing it. She has a new CD out called A Tribute to Richard Rodgers, and Shirley Jones joins us from NPR West in Culver City. Thanks so much. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
When I say that you were the darling of the musical partnership, I mean you were under contract to Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Right.
What did that mean to be under contract to them?
Well, it truly, I was the first and last one and only, you know. They never had anybody else under contract. And, you know, my career was one of those things that was a happening, and I mean that. I mean, I was on my way to college to become a veterinarian, and I stopped off in New York City where I knew a pianist, and he said, Rodgers and Hammerstein is having open auditions for anybody who wants to sing for them. They did it about once every 2 weeks because they had three shows running on Broadway. I'd never been to a professional audition of any kind, and I didn't even know who Rodgers and Hammerstein were. I was barely 18 years old. Anyway, I went to the audition. I won't make this a long story. It can be. But I sang for the casting director. He, in turn, called in Mr. Rodgers to hear me personally that day, and he, in turn, called Oscar Hammerstein at home to have him come and hear me. 3 weeks later, I was in my first Broadway show. I never got to college, South Pacific, and within the year, I was playing the lead in the motion picture of Oklahoma.
Amazing. There are two selections by Rodgers and Hammerstein on here.
Yes.
The song, I Have Dreamed.
Yes, I love that.
Why that one? What show is it from?
King and I.
Ah.
The King and I.
I have dreamed that your arms are lovely. I have dreamed what a joy you'll be. I have dreamed every word you whisper when you're close, close to me.
Are you singing in a lower register on the CD?
Yes, I am. And, you know, when Les Brown called me about doing it, I remember my husband said, but she doesn't sing that way. She's, you know, she sings in the high range. She does this. And Les Brown said, we'll change that. He meant it, too.
And
how I was thrilled.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was thrilled because it gave me an opportunity. You know, my voice, I mean, I was, my goodness, I was a coloratura soprano. I was an opera singer, you know. And what happens with age is we all know, you know, the voice lowers. And the problems I have, you know, in some of the songs that I'm still singing, it's not necessarily the high range, it's the middle range. Hmm. Because the voice, particularly with a soprano, the middle range gets very weak going up and down the scale, you know. But I can sing low, great. So I love it. And when he said, let's do it, I said, that's fabulous. It'll give me a new identity, you know.
And I should mention that you worked with Les Brown Jr., the son of
Yes.
Les Brown, who had his band of renown, I remember, as a band leader.
I sang with his father, too.
Did you really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
On a couple of shows. I believe it was television.
Wow. You sing, it seems, in the same range as your speaking voice. And I had read that Les Brown Jr. wanted to create a kind of intimate atmosphere.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. It's very warm. It's very sexy in many ways. You know, and Les was responsible for that in a way.
In these dreams, I've loved you so that by now I think I know what it's like to be loved by you.
I'm speaking with Shirley Jones. She has a new CD out called A Tribute to Richard Rodgers. Of course, we're coming up on Oscar season. And when you received your Oscar 51 years ago for supporting actress and Elmer Gantry, what do you remember about that night?
Well, first of all, I didn't think I was going to win because Janet Leigh, you know, was up for Psycho. So I was really the dark horse, big time dark horse, and I didn't expect to win. When I did, I was just overwhelmed. And, you know, that really, you know, a lot of people said, why are you doing this? Oh, my goodness, how dare you play a prostitute? You know, I got a lot of that. But it gave me the longevity that I've had in my career. My career was virtually over because they stopped making musical motion pictures. You know, they didn't fare too well in Europe. The European market didn't accept them. And they were so expensive to make, and they decided, nah, we don't need these anymore. So my career was over because they thought if you were a singer for some strange reason, you weren't an actress.
Let's hear a Rodgers and Hart tune, Spring Is Here.
Oh, I love that one, too.
Spring is here. Why doesn't the breeze delight me? Stars appear. Why doesn't the night invite me? Maybe it's because nobody loves me. Spring is here, I hear.
Is it true you turned down the role of Carol Brady in the Brady Bunch?
That's true.
Why?
That's
what? True. That's weird.
Well, you know, first of all, I had been, you know, a movie actor for a long time. You know, I did 30 films before I did The Partridge Family. And at that time, agents and managers, first of all, said, Shirley, don't do a television series, because it was a big step down to do television if you were a movie actor. Because even if it is successful, well, you'll be that character for the rest of your life, and your movie career will be in the toilet. Well, they were kind of right about that. But I turned down the Brady Bunch because it was just another, for me, ordinary mom with a lot of kids, and they'd been doing shows like that. Then the Partridge Family was offered to me, and I loved the idea of, you know, a musical family. And the most important part for me is that my children, I had three sons and stepson, David Cassidy, but my three sons had been all over the world with me on movie locations, but now it was school time. And I had to figure out a way to stay home and raise my kids and still work.
Have you been Shirley Partridge?
Yes, I have been Shirley Partridge most of my life. I'm telling you, the only people that know that I did more than that are people my age.
We'll end with a song, a beautiful song, Bewitched, Bothered.
Oh, great.
And Bewildered, wonderful song.
I'm wild again, beguiled again, a simpering, whimpering child again. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I.
How do you keep your voice in shape?
I try to sing a little bit every day. I really do. I never had to do that when I was younger. You know, I could get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and sing a high C. I can't do that anymore. It's now just placement of notes, you know, more with me now, and placement of words. There are certain words that I can sing brilliantly and other words that are hard for me to sing.
Like what?
Depending on where they go. The A sounds are hard for a singer. The A sounds are easy. The E sounds are easy. You know, the oo sounds are hard.
So bothered is harder to sing than bewildered.
Bothered and bewildered, yes.
Is that your singing for the day?
That's my singing for the day.
Are you sure?
A blue moon, you saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. That's on there, too.
The inimitable Shirley Jones. Her new CD is called A Tribute to Richard Rodgers, and Ms. Jones joined us from our studio at NPR West in Culver City. What a treat. Thank you so much for being
on
the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
And then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold.
Shirley Jones performs the songs of Rodgers and Hart from her new CD beginning March 15th at Feinstein's in New York. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
Without a love of my own. Without a love of my own. Without a love of my own.
This week, the new 112th Congress picks up where it left off after an unplanned timeout following last weekend's shootings in Arizona. But lawmakers won't ease back in. They'll go right back to one of the hottest issues they'll face all year, whether to repeal the sweeping health law passed in 2010. Joining us to talk about the debate and how the tone might change in the wake of the Arizona shootings is NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner. Nice to see you, Julie.
Nice to be here.
Remind us why the debate is happening now at the very beginning of the congressional session.
Well, it's something Republicans promised they would do during the elections. A number of these new members were elected with a vow to repeal this law. Now, the Republicans also know that this full repeal isn't going to go anywhere in the Senate. Even if it did, President Obama would veto it. So it's really something, a vote they want to get over with and done so they can get on to other things. Plan B, if you will.
What's Plan B?
Well, Plan B is a little bit more serious. Republicans are working on lots of ways to do what they call throw sand in the gears of the implementation of this health law. There are things like trying to slow down or cut off funding for it, block some of the regulations, and launch lots and lots of investigations into what they say are improper activities by federal officials in how they're putting the law into effect. Now, I should also add that over in the Senate, Democrats, who still control things in that chamber, are planning a series of hearings of their own to try to help educate the public about what's in the law so the public doesn't get such a one-sided message from the Republican House.
Well, we mentioned tone. Do you think the tone of the debate will actually change given the events of the past week?
Well, it's still a little hard to tell. Some things haven't changed. The name of the bill they're voting on this week, for example, much to the dismay of some of the Democrats, is still the Repealing the Job-Killing Health Care Law Act. But in some other ways, we're already seeing a marked difference. For example, here's House Majority Leader Eric Cantor from a news conference with reporters the week before last.
This is a job-killing health care bill. The bill itself spends entirely too much money. We know it's $1 trillion-plus price tag to the bill. That's money we don't have. And we just need to repeal it, as the American people have spoken out.
Now, I have to add that Cantor isn't among the more fire-breathing Republicans. But in announcing that the vote was being rescheduled for this week, a spokeswoman for Cantor put out this statement, and I want to read from it because it's got a very, very different tone. It says, as the White House noted, it's important for Congress to get back to work, and to that end, we will resume thoughtful consideration of the health care bill next week. Americans have legitimate concerns about the cost of the new health care law and its effect on the ability to grow jobs in our country. It is our expectation that the debate will continue to focus on those substantive policy differences surrounding the new law.
Do you think the Democrats will tone things down as well?
Well, I imagine they will. You know, Republicans haven't been alone in using this heated rhetoric when it comes to health care. This was Ed Markey of Massachusetts on the floor the week before last.
The Republicans don't care repeal shows they don't care about sick children with medical bills pushing families into bankruptcy. They don't care about grandma and grandpa who need help paying for prescription drugs.
Do you think a change in tone will have an effect on the outcome?
No. I think all the Republicans will vote for repeal. All the Democrats, or virtually most of the Democrats, will vote against repeal. But at least it may be a kinder and gentler debate.
NPR's health policy correspondent Julie Rovner. Thanks, Julie.
You're welcome.
The Australian Open begins tomorrow in a part of the country which is not inundated by floods. This first Grand Slam event of the year also serves as the launch of the 2011 tennis season. For a preview, Douglas Robson, who reports on tennis for USA Today, joins us from member station KQED. Welcome to the program.
No, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I understand you're not attending the Australian Open this year, but you've been to other Australian Opens a number of times. How does this compare to the other Grand Slam events?
Well, Roger Federer once called the Australian Open the happy slam. If Wimbledon is staid and clubby and traditional and the U.S. Open is high-octane and glitz, the Australian Open feels like a giant Barbie break. There's a real festive atmosphere.
Yeah. Let's talk about this season's cast of characters. Rafael Nadal of Spain, Roger Federer, they've had this great rivalry in recent years. What do you expect from them in Australia and this entire season?
They've won 21 of the last 23 slams. And of course, Nadal is coming off a spectacular season in which he won three of the four majors. And not incidentally, he is going for a fourth major in a row in Australia, the so-called Rafa Slam, which hasn't been done in 42 years since Rod Laver did it in 1969. Federer, of course, is the record holder. He has 16 majors, more than any other player, and is a defending Australian Open champion. And he comes in after really being the hottest player on tour the last few months. He beat Nadal in the year-end championships, but you almost have to tip Federer as the favorite.
Who are you watching on the women's side?
I mean, on the women's side, I think you've got the top seed, Caroline Wozniacki, and you know, the knock on her is that she hasn't won a Grand Slam yet. Kim Clijsters, who's a three-time U.S. Open champion, is probably the favorite in most people's eyes, and she really is someone that can, I think, restore some order to the game. I think with the Williams sisters sort of being in and out, Serena is the defending champ in Australia and won't be there. Venus will be there, but she's hardly played in the last few months, and it's hard to know what to expect from her.
Are you excited about this season?
I am. I think it's a great time. I mean, the men's game with the rivalry between Federer and Nadal is really one of the great rivalries in all of sports. These are two guys that really like each other off the court. I mean, they participate in exhibitions in each other's countries to raise money for their respective foundations. And yet once they step on the court, you know, it's all business. And the contrast in styles is just so beautiful. I mean, you've got Federer, who's sort of walking on air, and Nadal, who's the muscular grinder. And it's a great contrast and a really a special time in the sport.
The Australian Open begins tomorrow. Douglas Robson covers tennis for USA Today, and he joined us from NPR member station KQED. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
200 years ago this month, the wealthy socialites of New Orleans were just kicking off the carnival season. The high society plantation owners and their wives were hopping from one masquerade ball to the next, and all-night drinking parties were filled with the city's elite ruling classes. But what they didn't know is while they were partying, their slaves were plotting.
On the night of January 8th, the rain continued to come down. Water coursed along the wood roofs of the slave quarters, drowning their staccato voices with streaming, rushing noise. 25 dark faces looked on as the slave driver turned rebel, Charles Deland, laid out the plan and gave some final words of encouragement. Every man assembled knew that his presence meant a near certain death sentence if the revolt failed. No slave revolt in Louisiana had ever before been successful, and the punishment for failed rebellion was clear. Torture, decapitation, and one's head upon a pike.
That's author Daniel Rasmussen reading from his new book. It's the amazing story of the largest slave revolt in U.S. history. It's called American Uprising, and Daniel Rasmussen joins me here in the studio. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Let's start out by talking about Charles Deland. He's really the heart of this story. This is a man who was a slave, the son of a white plantation owner and a black slave. He, by all accounts, was a very loyal slave, right?
Absolutely. Charles had risen to the top of the planter hierarchy, I think partially because of his light skin. You know, being the son of a planter, he gained more trust. So he was able to rise to the top of the plantation and become a driver. What does that mean? A driver is like an overseer. They carry the whips. They punish the undisciplined slaves. They chase the ones that escape. They hold the keys to all the locked doors. He was Andrew's right-hand man. Mm. And in the eyes of many slaves—
This is Manuel Andrew.
Yep.
And it was a brutal plantation owner, as you go on to describe.
Absolutely. And in the eyes of the slaves, I think Charles must have seemed like the ultimate betrayer, mm-hmm. a man who was working with the master, you know, who was working to oppress them.
How did Charles Deland go from being this seemingly loyal slave driver who was presumably despised by slaves to becoming the mastermind of this insurrection?
Charles gained privileges because he was a driver, you know, better clothes, a nicer cabin, also the freedom to move, the freedom to meet with the leaders of other plantations, to talk to them, ostensibly probably about sugar planting. So Charles would move up and down the coast. And as he was doing this, rather than deliberating about the best time to plant sugar or harvest the crop, Charles was sowing the seeds of an insurrection. He was, in modern terms, the ultimate sleeper cell. Mm.
Tell me what happened that night, January 8th, 1811.
So January 8th, 1811, let's set the scene just a little bit. Why do the slaves choose January 8th? Three reasons. The first reason is that this is the start of Carnival, the build-up to Mardi Gras. And so the slaves choose this as an ideal time because of the lavish planter balls, the celebrations that are going on throughout this period. The planters would have huge parties, turtle, gumbo, and of course massive amounts of wine and brandy. The morning after one of these debauches was an ideal time to launch a revolt, and the slaves had figured that out. Second reason, William Claiborne, the governor of the territory, sends out the dragoons, which are the most impressive military force the Americans have, to Baton Rouge to fight the Spanish. And no coincidence that the slaves wait until America's embroiled in the war with the Spanish. The bulk of the American military force is gone. A mere 68 regular troops are left in New Orleans.
Wow.
And finally, on January 4th, a rainstorm blows in. Why is this important? Well, it means that you can't transport artillery. And so slaves armed with cane knives, axes, muskets, have a much better chance against another set of military forces only armed with muskets as well than they do against a force that has artillery. And
right.
so they wait. And on January 8th, Charles Deland gathers his men, 25 men on the plantation of Manuel Andre, and they launch their revolt. They sneak into the house in the middle of the night. Manuel Andre wakes with a fright to see Charles Deland, his driver, his trusted assistant, his loyal advisor, standing there with an axe, a plantation tool now transmuted into an icon of insurrection. And Manuel Andre is terrified, and he knows what to do, and he runs. As he runs, the slaves slice three long cuts into his body. And as he turns around to look back, he sees the slaves killing his son, Gilbert. Mm. What happens next? The slaves break into the militia depot on Manuel Andre's plantation. They get out militia uniforms. Charles and his men put on the militia uniforms. They gather the muskets, and they start to march towards New Orleans, shouting, "On to New Orleans and freedom or death." This is a sophisticated, politically motivated armed force consciously invoking military imagery, political imagery, to say, we're no longer slaves. Mm. We're men, and now we're free.
Daniel, what was the overall plan? I mean, they were headed towards New Orleans. What were they going to do?
You know, it's hard to say what exactly they intended. But if we look at other revolts, contemporaneous revolts, revolts that happened in 1812 in Cuba, for example, or, you know, what happened in Haiti, I think we can get a much more clear picture of what the slaves would have intended.
Yeah.
And that is the establishment of a black republic, an independent black republic on the shores of the Mississippi River.
What's fascinating in the book and the way you describe it is this contingent of slaves, as they make their way towards New Orleans, they gather, they collect more and more slaves come out of plantations to join them. The ranks swell to 500, as you describe. They never make it to New Orleans, and of course, we don't want to give away too much of the story. They are routed and defeated by a small contingent of American soldiers along with plantation owners. The result is bloody and brutal. What happens to the slaves who were killed and even those who survived?
The planters break the slave line. On the spot, they kill between 40 and 60 slaves. They catch Charles Deland, they chop off his limbs, they shoot him in both thighs, and they burn him alive. And then, obsessively, collectively, they chop off the heads of the defeated slave rebels and put them on poles.
And they put those poles all along that path out of New Orleans, what's called the River Road. The scene from Spartacus comes to mind, you know, in the Via Appia, where the heads of slaves are put on stakes. Daniel Rasmussen, why don't we know about this story? We know about Nat Turner. We know about John Brown. It's not too far from where we're sitting here in Washington, D.C., over down in Harper's Ferry. This was the largest slave revolt that we now know of in American history, but we haven't known much about it since now.
It's shocking. It's one of the most significant moments of political amnesia in our nation's history. The largest slave revolt. And today, here in January 2011, is the bicentennial of the revolt. Mm. And yet, this story is almost entirely absent from the textbooks and the history books. Why? As soon as it happened, the planters, first of all, killed 100 slaves, put their heads on poles, and then they sought to write the slaves out of history. They described them as criminals, as brigands in their language. And they say that the revolt was quickly and easily suppressed. They describe the trials, and they say, we sentenced these brigands for their crimes. What they don't say is the real story. Because in their minds, the planters need to sanctify the violence that they've just committed. And so they want to portray themselves as just, as righteous, and the slaves as guilty, as criminal. They cannot acknowledge that the slaves were anything more than criminals. If they acknowledge that the slaves are not property or not chattel, but are people with real political ideals...
That begins to undermine everything they stand for.
It undermines the entire ideology that underlaid slavery.
That was your intention. I mean, I've read that you actually wanted people to know about this story of heroism, another side of slave history.
Yes, too often, I think, when we think about slavery, we feel guilty and ashamed and depressed. And we think of the slaves as victims. But the slaves were more than that. These were heroes. These were men that fought and died for their beliefs in freedom and equality. What I'm trying to do is not only bring their story to tell you about Charles Delaunay, about Cook, about Quamana, but to think about these enslaved men and women as people who contributed to American history, who fought and died for their beliefs, and who were brave and heroic.
That's Daniel Rasmussen. He is the author of the new book, American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. Daniel, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.